This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 11th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Culture is brought to you in association with the Spanish Tourist Office. Hello and welcome to the 70th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today's a wonderfully packed confection, like a box of sugared almonds if you're feeling Edwardian, or a mega pack of Kellogg's Crave if you're feeling contemporary. What it is, ladies and gentlemen, is a radio feast, an aural delight that's gone out and about around the world to deliver to you, dear listener, this. We entertain Grammy Award-winning country rock legend Steve Earle for a Midori House session and a spot of putting the world to rights while he's at it.
You know, we're seeing the hardest times out there that we've seen in a long time. And the record started becoming about what I was seeing out the window of a really nice Canadian-made bus traveling throughout North America.
We'll head to Egypt to see how the much-lauded spring has affected pop culture. We shall explore the sounds of that state's new music scene. And we'll keep closer to home as we make like the jam and go underground to meet Mark Wallinger, the British artist chosen by The Tube to celebrate and venerate its labyrinthine 150-year birthday.
Every night I used to go to sleep to the sound of... So it's like a very soothing kind of presence in my childhood, really. I cherish The Tube, yes.
Plus, and I don't know how we fit it all in, the Burma Literary Festival, and why not an art fair in Madrid. It's a wonderful technicolour cultural umbrella. It's the next hour here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. So we were treated to a pretty spectacular Midori House session last week, none other than country rock royalty in the form of Steve Earle. He's a singer, songwriter, campaigner and moral guardian of Texas and Nashville, and what with the Grammys yesterday, we can say that he's earned more of those than he has Spurs, even. Here he is performing Devil's Right Hand.
Got my first pistols, a cap and ball coat. Shoot his ass and line them, but you load them my slow. Load them my slow. Soon I'm paying that. You can get you into trouble, but you can't get you out. Then I went and got myself a Colt 45. Called a peacemaker, but I never knew why. Never knew why. Didn't understand. Mama says a pistol is the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. Mama says a pistol is the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. Mama says a pistol is the devil's right hand. Kirky in a company town. Caught a minor cheating and shot the dog down. Shot the dog down. Watch your man fall. Never touch his horse, we never had a chance to draw. My trial was in the morning and the drug me out of bed. Asked me how I pleaded, not guilty. I said, not guilty. I said, got the wrong man. Nothing touched the trigger but the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. Mama says a pistol is the devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. The devil's right hand. Nothing touch a trigger but the devil's right hand. Mama says a pistol is the devil's right hand. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
That was Steve Earle performing Devil's Right Hand for you, dear listeners, from that great Midori House session last week. You know how it works. We'll hear more from him later on, plus an interview with the man himself. Well, next we're off to Egypt, but to start the show, we're staying in London, where the London Underground turns 150 this year. There have been a few ways that transport nerds and design aficionados have managed to join hands and praise what is perhaps the most famous transport brand in the world. It might seem that artworks have been commissioned for the Tube for more than the 20 years that they have, but that's probably testament to the wonderful iconography and design palette that's so often heralded as classic. Last week was the big one. Art on the Underground, the groovy bit of the tube, unveiled 270 original works under the title Labyrinth by the British Turner Prize winning artist Mark Wallinger. Every tube station in London will possess one of Wallinger's labyrinths, a 60 by 60 black and white enamel work that call to mind plan views of mazes, Maori tattoos, perhaps a top-down look at the human brain. Katie and I popped along to the unveiling down on the platform at St James's Park Station, that which sits beneath Tube HQ.
The labyrinths are manufactured by the same people that make the signage for the Underground, so it's completely in keeping with that. So it's a vitreous enamel, very like punchy black and white graphics. The labyrinths are all circular, so that kind of echoes the roundel to an extent, and the red cross at the bottom represents us, I guess, or it says you are here, and that gives you the cue to enter into the puzzle, if you like.
Labyrinth was a work that Mark Wallinger came up with after long discussions with him over the last 2 years, probably more than 2 years.
Tamsin Dillon is head of Art on the Underground. Why Wallinger, we wondered.
Art on the Underground's been commissioning works now for 10 years or more, building on the heritage of working with artists over the last 100 years or so for London Underground. And for this landmark occasion, for the 150th anniversary, we wanted to make sure that we worked with an artist who of a significant calibre, and who would have some kind of association already with London Underground and would have a passion for it. And Mark's work stands out as a world-class artist. He's been making work for a number of years that reflects on, in a very witty and observant way, in many different contexts. And he'd also made two works of his own in the past that actually are based on and are about London Underground. One of them, Angel, made at Angel Tube Station, and the other work, All Lines Meet at Infinity on the Circle Line. So he was an artist that we were very keen to invite because it seemed to be a project that he would be interested in and would certainly be able to take on, and would come up with something that would really capture this moment in an important way.
And in terms of the graphics of it, is this something that you kind of work with Mark on, or was it something that was simply unveiled to you one day as well?
Mark was very much in control of the whole design of the piece, but there was a moment, I suppose you could say it was a eureka moment for him that he described to me, where he realised that the real challenge for this work was going to be to make something that would stand out and have its own identity whilst also being able to fit in and add to the lexicon of symbols and design on London Underground. And to think of, he was also thinking about the way people make their journeys on the tube and somehow coming up with a way of combining all of those different elements. And I suppose he was thinking about those complicated journeys when he came up with this idea of the labyrinth and started exploring it.
And then, of course, we had a chat with Mark Wallinger himself. Where did he find his inspiration for his labyrinth?
Between the tube map and the roundel and all that kind of history of art and design of the tube, it invited something that kind of honoured that but kind of took it somewhere else again. So I suppose it's kind of a map, but it's an abstract sign, really. And it's and it kind of, these labyrinths are quite brain-like looking as well, so they kind of describe the organ that's contemplating it, I guess.
And how does it's, I guess the challenge also, making a piece that stands out against all the well-known iconography of the tube, some of the tube stations, beautiful or ugly, or ugly beautiful, there's a lot going on in all of them. This kind of seems like quite a moment of calm for people when they set eyes on it,
I would hope so. Thanks. I mean, I think that's kind of what I was thinking about, and I suppose you kind of enter into a kind of contemplative state, or there's that kind of interim thing that the tube is part of, and that's sort of, it's transport, but it's actually transporting sometimes, you know, because, you know, you have to kind of put your mind somewhere to not just think about the way you're being shuttled sideways underground with millions of other people kind of thing.
And it'd be nice maybe to end right back at the beginning when you've got such an open brief, as you said. Where the hell do you start? I mean, I guess lots of people think of the tube as a labyrinth.
Yes.
Was that your kickoff?
Yeah, I think I was drawn to the circular and the round all, having played with these mirrors. I mean, literally, it came when I started drawing on the mirrors. I think I drew a spiral at first, and then it was messing about, and then suddenly the maze or labyrinth came to me, and then just sort of researching it, just, you know, the most famous, earliest Cretan maze, you know, is very brain-like, and that kind of clinched it for me, really, yeah. I describe myself as a child of the tube, and you know, my mum still lives in the house where I was brought up, and, hundreds of yards or so behind was the tube line between Chigwell and Grange Hill, and so, you know, every night I used to go to sleep to the sound of, you know, so it's like a very soothing kind of presence in my childhood, really, and so, yeah, I cherish the tube, yes, yeah.
Mark Wallinger's far from the first artist to dress and comment on the Underground. Mike Ashworth is one of the trustees of the Underground's design heritage. He told me about spotting the difference between art and design on those fabled lines.
I think for many years there was quite a tension in the Underground, particularly in the 1920s and 30s, where it was felt that really the art and design should be implicit in the architecture and layout of our stations and the things you find in stations. So for, you know, the typeface, for example, which dates from 1916 by Edward Johnson, of course, incredibly important 20th century calligrapher, and that's actually part, if you like, of our DNA. And if you look at the Stabler tiles that were introduced in the late 1930s on stations like Bethnal Green, again, they're designed to be an inherent part of the look and feel of the Underground. So for many, many years, I think there was that tension.
It's a tough place for art to sit as well, because there's such a lot of infographics, there's such a lot of wonderful design, there's such a lot of standout stuff, as well as advertising and directional signage and stuff as well. It's quite a busy place for art to sit, isn't it? It's quite a challenge for an artwork to stand out against all the rest of it.
I think it is a challenge, as you say, you know, our stations are visually very busy as well as being very busy. But I think one of the great joys of art on the Underground is almost like that undiscovered little secret. And I think that great thing about Mark Wallinger's work is just that, is there's going to be a piece on every station. And it's going to be that ability of just glancing at it and perhaps stopping people and making them think a little bit, you know, a time to pause and reflect on this marvellous piece of artwork that we're putting in, which is so much part of the programme that we've developed.
And we were talking earlier about it's going to be rolled out across all the stations in the network. How many stations are there? 250?
We own 260, we serve 275. So it's quite a programme to roll these out across the entire network. And I think it's the first time, other than the Roundel, that we've ever introduced something that will be available on all our stations. So that's quite a coup for Art on the Underground.
And there we have it. I expect someone will go to each station and take a picture of every artwork and put them on Tumblr or something. Maybe you fancy doing it yourself if you've got a spare month. I'd recommend Park Royal Tube Station. It's very beautiful. Wallinger's pieces will be up forever, so get your iSpy book out and tick them off. We loved them, even if we did think they were a bit, well, small. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we're headed now to Egypt. It's been over 2 years since Egyptians first took to the streets, demanding the end of Hosni Mubarak's three-decade dictatorship. Since then, there have been drastic changes, political and economic, but also cultural. Egypt had a top-down model of cultural production, with most music made by elites and consumed by the working classes. But Egyptian artists and musicians are changing that, and among them are a group of DJs that have popularised a new form of Egyptian music called Mahganat, or festival music. Rebecca Collard headed down Cairo Way to find out more.
Until last year, Amr Haha played this music primarily in the streets of his working class neighborhood in South Cairo. Amr and his small crew of DJs played weddings and festivals, mixing electronic beats with Arabic music and often explicit lyrics. For years, the music was popular with Cairo's impoverished, as Amr and the others spoke about the reality of life for the masses living under dictatorship. But last year, songs like this one went viral online, attracting thousands of views, some earning more than 1 million hits. Now you can hear Mahagranat, or festival music, pumping from Mercedes in upper-class neighborhoods. And Amr and his crew now play hip downtown clubs and events attended by Egypt's middle class, revolutionaries and hipsters, breaking a long-standing tradition of commercially led music in the country. For decades, Egypt's music scene was dominated by pop music and cliched love ballads. But the political uprising is also creating a space for new cultural production. I head to downtown Cairo to an event featuring Amr and his partners, Ala 50 and Sadat. This night, they're playing a party at the Greek Club, a popular venue on the second floor of an ornate old building in the center of the city. Amr is the best known of these musicians. His name is synonymous with the new genre of Mahagranat music. He started 8 years ago, performing in the streets of his neighborhood of An Shams. But today, I meet him in the stone courtyard outside the club. His head tucked inside a hooded jumper, he's surprisingly soft-spoken. Our music is hard to define, says Amr. It differs from shabi, or people's music, as it mixes Arabic music with R&B and house beats, and is voiced over with lyrics. The crowd inside is mostly young, middle-class Egyptians, activists, and a few foreigners. Men and women crowd the dance floor. Among them is Wael Iskander, an engineer and blogger who now regularly attends Mahagranat shows.
There was a problem generally with our music, that what we're having is just like commercialized Eastern kind of music. And once upon a time, somehow we stumbled across them on YouTube. And we found that they were doing a very, very interesting mix between like hip-hop, rap, or what have you, and true Egyptian styled music. They're talking about things that concern them, whether they're just like economic things or just like simple, love, romantic things, but they're talking about them in a very, very simple language that represents their society needs.
For Wael, the rise in the street music reflects the goals of Egypt's ongoing revolution.
That the revolution is trying to cancel out the divide between the classes, and most of it has been about that social justice part, bringing us closer. So no matter what happens, we want us to be closer to our countrymen, whoever they are. And that band there, they represent people. They're not reading about politics, they're living it. They're living under poverty, they're living under like the dire situation that we're in. So that is the epitome of it all, right?
Ala 50 is one of Amr's mic men, who sings over his beats. He stands in front of Amr's DJ table, rocking to the beat as he raps over the music. Some of these lyrics are overtly political, criticizing Egypt's new rulers, the Muslim Brotherhood. But other times, they simply sing out the reality in Egypt's poorer neighborhoods.
مثلا يعني ايه مثلا يعني المحل ده بيبيع خمره باين اللي هو بيبيع خمره خلاص الناس شافاه وسكت.
We sing about social problems, addiction, sexual harassment and the oppression of women, says La. But we also sing about personal problems like the loyalty of friends and romantic pursuits.
كذا حاجه بتحصل وما انا مجمعهم كلهم في بعضيهم وبقول الحاجات دي بتحصل.
Many of the subjects Allah and the others sing about are considered taboo in Egypt. But some Egyptians, like Soha, a human rights worker from the upper-class neighborhood of Madi, says this is part of the draw.
It talks about a lot of taboos. It brings up a lot of things that people wouldn't talk about normally in society. So it's liberating in a way, because you're like, oh my God, he just said that. But there's this atmosphere of togetherness and community, and that just speaks to us, I guess, and a lot of dancing, and it's all dancing in groups, not, you know what I mean? It's not a show, it's just a lot of people getting together and just dancing and having fun.
As Egypt's revolution continues, the changing cultural landscape is providing space and inspiration for Egypt's artists, and to some degree eroding the deeply entrenched barriers between the country's social classes, offering some hope for a new Egypt. For Monocle in Cairo, I'm Rebecca Collard.
Thanks, Rebecca, and you're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound. From Egypt, next we're off to Burma to hear about their first ever International Literary Festival. Stay tuned.
Whether you're sampling gourmet treats at Madrid's Gastro Festival or visiting the Rioja region during the wine harvest, Spain serves up the very best in cuisine and wines. Discover a taste for Spain. Visit ineedspain.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where now we're headed to Burma. As recently as 6 months ago, an international literary festival in the Southeast Asian nation would not have been possible. For the 5 decades that it was ruled by a military junta, closed off to the outside world, Burma had some of the strictest censorship laws of any country. Political books were banned, along with many works of fiction, history, and in particular the memoirs of the pro-democracy leader and Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, or Dor Suu as she's known in the country. But last weekend, Burma held its first ever International Literary Festival, an event that drew writers and visitors from around the world to talk poetry and politics in an open celebration of the country's newfound freedom of speech. Commercially, it was also a significant moment. The Myanmar Publishers and Booksellers Association reported that Burma's publishing market is now worth an estimated $50 million and growing at 30% a year, as thousands of books that were previously off-limits are made available for the first time. As Emily Ford reports from Rangoon.
Ever since the Burmese government formally abolished censorship in August last year, the books market in this formerly isolated Southeast Asian nation has begun to come alive. People here talk about a publishing spring, the revival of what used to be a vibrant literary tradition in the former British colony. In an idyllic setting on the banks of Inya Lake in Rangoon, Burma's largest city, there is a real sense of excitement that an event like the Irrawaddy Literary Festival can even take place at all. Authors have travelled from across the world to be here, and the bookstalls are packed with everyone from local teenagers to literary agents, and even some of Burma's famous Buddhist monks in their striking burgundy robes. Dr. Thanthor Kong is the chief executive of the Myanmar Book Centre, the country's largest importer of English language publications. Every year, he imports $2 million worth of books into the country. Since the censorship regime ended, business has boomed.
Oh, I rushed to order to all the major publishers, you know, hey, because we have contacts with many overseas publishers. They're also very happy. Before, we cannot import Dalai Lama, any books like Dalai Lama or the Nelson Mandela are restricted. We can't import. Even the biography is not allowed. Now you can. Even Dor Suu book is allowed, you know, that means everything has changed already. Just within 1 year, absolutely. Now so many publishers are not publishing. So this is a really challenging time, very exciting time for all of us in the book world, you know.
Major international publishing houses are also keen to play their part in Burma's literary renaissance. David Parrish is the sales and marketing director for the East Asia division of the publisher Random House, which is sponsoring the Irrawaddy Festival, and which last summer became one of the first major foreign publishers to enter the market. He expects that sales to Burma could reach six figures in as little as 3 to 5 years.
Here we are, February 2013, a matter of months after censorship came to an end in July, August time last year. So the books we couldn't sell here in July last year were now openly on sale and have been since August or September last year, but been talked about. I mean, it's just a massive step forward.
As Burma continues its rapid reform process, It is rushing to catch up on skills that for decades went neglected, and for this it needs books. The Ministry of Education is planning significant investments to enable schools and universities to buy educational books and English language texts. Meanwhile, retailers attending the festival say there is a huge public appetite for everything from children's books to business texts, literary fiction, and even self-help books. However, despite the commercial potential of Burma's literary revival, challenges remain. One of the biggest obstacles for publishers looking at the market is affordability. In a country where most people still live on about a dollar a day, a book is a luxury item. Jane Hayne is the organizer of the festival, whose work over the past 6 months secured a host of leading international speakers, including British historian William Dalrymple, Jung Chang, the author of Wild Swans, and the Indian writer Vikram Seth.
The overriding reason for having it was to give Burmese people the chance to actually read modern literature. And that was another reason for even starting to think about the festival. The paucity of new books, of any form of new literature, was back then, 2 years ago, it just didn't exist. And seeing these lovingly photocopied and bound with cut out pieces of fabric books, it was sad. It was really, really sad. It's something that's so easily available to people in other countries. That really, in many ways, that was the inspiration, seeing how difficult it was to find new, modern, affordable literature.
But aside from the romanticism of illicit copying that Ms. Hayne describes, Burma's thriving trade in pirated books is a serious problem for writers and publishers looking to make money in the country. Publishers here say that a new intellectual property law that the government has promised to introduce this year will be critical to allowing a legitimate market to take shape. Rangoon resident Thant Myint U is one of Burma's best-known authors, whose English language books on the country, River of Lost Footsteps and Where China Meets India, have garnered praise across the world.
This is an incredibly literary culture. I mean, people read a lot. It could be partly because there's no electricity and they can't watch TV or do anything else, but I think it's always been the case, and it's survived for whatever reason. And so there's a very rich indigenous literary culture. One thing that has sort of dampened writing here is just the economics of it. It's been very difficult for writers to make a living because of low income levels in general, the pricing of books, the distribution, the cost of distributing books. If those things start to change, if income levels rise a bit, I think that you could see a new sort of golden age in terms of publishing and literature here.
Addressing a crowded hall at the festival, Aung San Suu Kyi, the pro-democracy campaigner who spent 15 years under house arrest, told of her own plans to make it possible for more people in Burma to have access to books.
When I was in England, I lived in a little village outside Oxford for a few months. And during that time, I got to appreciate the mobile library system. It was a very good system, and I would like to introduce this to our constituents, to my township. And if that works out, I would like to introduce it to other townships as well, so that as many of our people as possible will have access to books and they will learn to use libraries.
For Monocle in Rangoon, I'm Emily Ford.
You're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Still to come in part two, we visit Madrid's art fair, Arco, and wonder why Spain and art fairs never seem to appear in the same sentence. We immerse ourselves in the sounds of Aleppo's war zone as a photographer makes his affecting new show, Extrasensory. And as it's Grammy time, we'll have a chat with and a couple of tracks from the musical legend who is Steve Earle. So, to that first, Steve Earle is the much-decorated singer, songwriter, novelist and campaigner, a Texan who's wary of guns and is far happier wielding his trusty electric acoustic. His upcoming album, Low Highway, is out in April, in it, cautionary tales of contemporary USA. Steve came in and performed a Midori House session for us last week, and then he sat down for a chat with Monocle's own Steve Earle aficionado, Andrew Muller.
Travelling now on the low highway, 3,000 miles to the Frisco Bay. across the rivers wild and the lonesome plains, up a coast and down, back again. I saw empty houses on dead-end streets, people lining up against something to eat, and the ghost of America watching me through the broken windows in the factories. Naked bones of a better day as I rode down the low highway. Traveling on the low highway by the yellow moon and light day, a snow white crown on the mountaintop to the valley down where the shadows fall. I met a man with a rifle in his hand, been away to battle in a distant land. We taught him to hate, taught him to kill. Now he's out on the road with a hole to fill. Nobody knows the price he paid, so he's taking his toll on the low highway. Listening, wheels turning round on the asphalt scene. Every sound is a prophecy. Heard an old man grumble, a young girl cry. A brick wall crumble, a white dove fly. Call for justice and a cry for peace. Voice of reason and the roar of the beast. Every mile was a prayer I prayed as I rode down the low highway.
It's about me being on the road, and hopefully it's not... I don't think people want to hear about you feeling sorry for yourself because you're riding around in a bus that costs more than their house. And I never have thought that. And it started out being just about what, you know, I wanted to make a record with the band I've got now because it's the best band I've ever had. And then we were on the road and, you know, I've been writing about New Orleans already. And a lot of the reason New Orleans is in the shape that it's in, you know, the lights going out during the Super Bowl the other night. Mm. It's like... that's a horrible thing to happen that made me feel really bad because it's been 10 Super Bowls, you know, in New Orleans. And it's they may not get one for a while now because we haven't fixed New Orleans. We haven't even come close. And one of the reasons for that is that we don't have the resources to fix New Orleans. You know, we're seeing the hardest times out there that we've seen in a long time. And the record started becoming about what I was seeing out the window of a, you know, a really nice Canadian-made bus traveling throughout North America and in Europe as well. It occurred to me that people were having a hard time, but people were still coming to see us, which was I was very appreciative of. And, you know, it makes you grateful that you got a job when there's a lot of people that don't, and especially when you get to do something that you really love doing like I do. So it started being about, I hope it's not just about me. I think it's about My last record was about me. There's no doubt about that. This one, I think, is about the people, for the most part, that I saw, you know, along the road over the last couple of years.
The title track kind of struck me as sort of a melancholy bookend to Guitar Town, the song. And there's a song on the album, Down the Road Part 2, which is an explicit sequel to a song on Guitar Town, the album.
Well, Guitar Town and Down the Road were specifically written to be the opening and the closing tracks of Guitar Town. They were the first two things written. And so you're right about that. It just became obvious to me that this record was related in some ways to Guitar Town and those other records that I made. I probably get homesick more now than I ever have just because I live in New York and I like New York so much, so I miss being there. But, you know, for a while there, I thought I had it made. I had my family traveling with me and on the road. But now, you know, we have a little boy and he's getting too old to drag around. He's going to have to go to school and he needs to be in one place. And so I'm out here on the road by myself again. And that's the way, you know, I did the last tour. Did about half of the last tour by myself, the end of it, and Allison's in the band on the record, but she her touring days are done for a while. She's going to have to be home with John Henry.
Also wanted to ask about a couple of the non-musical things you're working on. You are, I believe, working on the book you always swore you'd never write, which is the memoir. Why the change of mind?
John Henry has autism, and it's about money, and I've never made an artistic decision based on money in my life, but I don't think I'll go to hell for this one. He was diagnosed when he was just short of his second birthday, so we've had him in therapy. He starts a school coming up when he turns 3, as soon as he's old enough in New York City, that's really expensive, but it seems to be the place that he needs to be. And I'm not rich. I make really, really good money, but I work really hard doing it. And, you know, I've been able to say no. I made enough money, I've been able to say no to a lot of stuff. But people have talked to me about a memoir for a while. And, you know, I had a deal on the table for a novel. And I just, when I figured out how much this was going to cost, I went back to my editor and just asked, out of curiosity, like what a memoir would be worth. And it turned out it was quite a bit more than the novel. And I had a good offer for the novel. So we did a 2-book deal, and it's front-loaded for the memoir to be first. And so I'm writing it. The bar is high. It's not, I'm not competing with Keith Richards. I'm competing with Bob Dylan and Patti Smith. It's a literary memoir. It's not an autobiography. So I just don't, it needs to be something I can be proud of. And I think I'm going to be able to do it and tour because I don't have to make it up. So I've been working on it for a while. It's sort of is the active project right now, at least until the tour starts.
How different do you find the process of writing songs and writing long-form prose?
Well, I write songs practically in my sleep. Writing prose is painful because, you know, I type like a sports writer and I don't, you know, a couple of fingers. I took personal typing in high school, and when I started, I typed 38 words a minute or something. And when I finished, I typed 24. And so I was actually worse. And I don't know why, but I struggle with that. So it's physically grueling to sit at a word processor and type. But I do it. I've done it, you know, this is my third book I'm working on now. It kind of blows my mind, but it's different. It's more, you have to, especially a novel, you have to wake up in the morning and get yourself in the groove. And when you get out of the groove for a day, it takes days to get back in again. That's the only thing. I've had to, out of necessity, both of my books had to walk away from them and come back and finish them. The short stories were different. I could finish those. I'm going to write another play, but I owe this publisher a couple of books first. So I'm going to do that first.
And that was Andrew Miller and Steve Earle in conversation. Before that, you heard Steve performing the title track from his new record, Low Highway. You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound. Next up, what does Syria sound like?
A front row seat in a Roman amphitheatre for Merida's theatre festival. Rubbing shoulders with the stars at the San Sebastian Film Festival. Spain's performing arts are a visual feast. Dive into Spanish culture. Visit Spain.info.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where now we're talking photography, because a rather interesting exhibition is set to open this week in Berlin. Young German photographer Just is a child of Berlin's graffiti and street art scene, and so far the main body of his work has been capturing graffiti artists in action, tiptoeing across snow-covered rooftops, abseiling down the side of six-story buildings, and spray-painting the sides of trains. But there's another side to this artist. In December, he went to Aleppo, Syria, to document the everyday life of a city at war. The exhibition of his work opens this week in Berlin and is accompanied by a revealing soundscape which helps capture the atmosphere and feel of living in a city under siege. Cinnamon Nippard went to meet Just at the gallery and sent us this report.
Inside Aleppo, you constantly can hear shellings and you can hear tanks, and yeah, it's like an background noise you hear all the time, and you get pretty used to it pretty quick.
Letters from Aleppo is graffiti artist and photographer Just's way of expressing his impressions of his 6 days in Syria. It's an exhibition full of moving and often harrowing works. One such example is the pictures he took while visiting a psychiatric clinic close to the front line. The doctors and nurses fled months ago, and the neighbourhood was empty except for one man who was trying to take care of the 60 patients.
I never felt something so disturbing in my life. Everything was wet, it was raining inside the house. It's winter in Syria and it's very cold. It's minus degrees, and the people were walking barefoot, and they had no clothes, and there were no shelves, no books, no plants, no tables, just like very old steel beds. It was just horrible. Yeah, people were screaming constantly. There was no food, no medicine.
Just continued to explore the nightmarish landscape of a city under siege. He wanted to visit the old markets or souks in the parts of Aleppo that are World Heritage listed. On his way there, Just and his fixer met a man cleaning his car.
He actually was cleaning the blood of his brother, who got shot by a sniper.
Just took a photo of the man sitting behind the steering wheel, and you can see where the bullet hit, going through the metal door frame. Just says everyone he met had a story of loss. The trip also involved travelling to the front line to meet members of the Free Syrian Army.
You really could tell that you're on your way to the front line because the streets were empty. There was no one walking anymore, no cars. The streets were full of wreckage. The houses were burned. Everything was broken. And we went down some of those streets when we suddenly went inside a house, and we continued our way to the front line inside of houses. It was kind of a secret path they made themselves to be safe, to not walk the open streets.
This secret path left a lasting impression.
This was a very strange feeling, like walking through all those lives of these people. You had picture frames on the walls, or like schoolwork from kids, or toys even on the floor. It was very, very surreal.
Hospitals were off limits for the camera to try and protect medical staff and their patients. Just was only allowed to take one photo from the inside of a bakery, as these too are secret places helping the city's residents to survive the conflict. Outside, the streets were overflowing with debris and garbage, and in the background was the constant sound of gunfire and shelling. Thomas Rasloff is a German photojournalist who helped Just get into Aleppo. He explains how he captured what has become the soundtrack to the exhibition.
Each night the battle starts, it comes dark, you know, maybe tanks, mortar shells, heavy machine guns, something like that, and decided to use my iPhone and record the sound because nobody knows how it works.
Initially, Rasloff made the recording because he wanted to show his friends what a war zone sounds like, but Just decided to incorporate the audio into the exhibition. Guillaume Trottin, founder and curator of the Open Walls Gallery in Berlin, says the sound of Aleppo is an essential part of the upcoming exhibition of Just's work.
What we are trying to do in the setup is to have a three-dimensional narrative with images, with the letters he wrote to his friends from Aleppo. And when you hear the sound that are recorded at night, trust me, with the lights we're going to have, it's going to put you in that context. also because of the room we use, which is a bit destroyed and broken. The Syrian part of the show is built as an experience.
Just's photographs aren't detached. You can feel the conversations and the stories behind the images. Trottin says this is Just's special talent.
It's his ability to get into a scene, to get the trust from the people he will photograph. And you see that very obviously when you look at his street art and graffiti photo, to catch those moments, to be so close with the artist, you definitely need to have their trust. And there's an analogy with what he did in Aleppo, because it's like one scene led him to another, and it's the topic is completely different, but the approach is the same. It's getting people trust and being in the right place at the right moment, which makes his photos, his photography so special and so strong.
Letters from Aleppo opens on the 15th of February at Berlin's Open Walls Gallery. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Cinnamon Nippard.
And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24, where I'm suddenly feeling like I've got rather a boring name. From Berlin photography to finish the show, we move now to Spain, where the premier annual contemporary art fair Arco Madrid kicks off this week. We here at The Culture Show saw it as the perfect opportunity to throw the spotlight on that city's vibrant art scene. The sector has been facing some notable struggles of late, a grating recession and a sales tax hike among the principal gripes. But this doesn't mean the city's creative mojo is also being stifled. As our Madrid correspondent Liam Alders found, the economic crisis is not only energising the artistic community, but forcing them to get business savvy too. At a crowded opening, Liam first sat down with Arco director Carlos Uroth.
I think it's going to be a great addition of the fair. We'll have Turkey as invited country, and we've done an effort in selecting the best galleries, very cutting edge in the opening section, and encouraging the galleries to do a special presentation of one of their artists, what we call the highlighted artist, and I think it's going to be different to other fairs. I think Arco Madrid is a very good fair to discover artists. We have lots of curated sections, not only the invited country with Turkey. We also have this special section for young galleries with less than 7 years, with two curators selecting them. We have a special Latin American section with five curators all over from Latin America selecting them. So it's an art fair where you can discover artists at the same time as important curators, artists that are going to be in biennials, in important museum shows, and the collectors can discover them at the same time as those professionals.
Is there anything new this year that art lovers can expect?
Yes, we're launching a new platform for the galleries to sell works under 5,000 euros. We think there's a whole commerce online that it's probably people that are not going to the galleries and not even coming to art fairs. So we didn't want to do a virtual replica of the fair, but we wanted to select the works that normally they don't show, because the walls are too expensive or because they show more expensive works at the fair. Art fairs have to be very inventive to try to get new customers into the sector. It's not only taking the collectors from the galleries, but creating new collectors. We have this initiative, Arco Collect Online. We have something to encourage people buying their first artworks at the fair called First Collectors, in which we advise them or we let them know how to do their first purchases. So for Arco, it's very important to create new clients. You know, we understand in our difficult moments and that maybe the buyers that we're buying are not buying anymore. So we need to get new people into the market, into the system. We import lots of collectors from abroad, and we're trying to look for the people who are still doing money to get interested in the arts and know how to spend in interesting artworks.
It's interesting you say that as well, because there's a street in Madrid called Dr. Fourquet where even this year you said something like four or five new galleries have opened on that street. So obviously something is happening. It's not struggling as much as people would think.
No, I think there's a generational change. There are very important galleries who are retiring, and there are new galleries that are opening in this Dr. Fourquet street. There are also two galleries from Barcelona and from Pamplona that are coming to Madrid. Obviously, the center of the art market in Spain is Madrid. And so there are new projects who are starting now, and probably in a few years they will be more important and more well-known. But all these galleries are very international. I think now the market is very international. It's not only about the Spanish clients, it's about Latin American clients, about people visiting Madrid from all over the world. And that's what these galleries are trying to get.
But it's not all about the main event. Now in its fourth year, Just Mad is a satellite fair concentrating on emerging artists. I'm talking to artistic director Javier Duero.
In Just Mad, the person will see young galleries and young spaces, will see young artists, of course, and the main difference is the novelty, the freshness, the prices. Prices are much more affordable, and the proposals in terms of sections and programs.
Okay, as everyone knows, the art world in particular is suffering under the crisis, and there's been a huge tax increase recently as well. One thing I'm noticing during the economic crisis in a lot of sectors is the spirit of collaboration, a lot of people coming together to try and get through this tough time. Is that happening in the art world as well?
In the art world, this kind of philosophy of, you know, like networking and collaborating is getting right now, specifically, I would say, for young generations, like people under 40 years, below 40 years. For them, is the only way, not just to work, but the only way to really survive.
They're not all from Madrid either. A lot of them are from South America as well. We were talking before about whether Madrid is the traditional gateway to the South American art market. Is that true?
We are very close to South America, culturally, obviously, because of historical reasons. But in terms of commerce, in terms of cultural exchange, in terms of networking, that's something that needs to be stimulated. We need to invest money, resources, time, effort, energy. You have to think like Spain in the 80s, when we became a democratic country, etc., rather than looking to South America, which could be this natural gateway, we have to look to Europe. We've been looking to Europe in the past 30 years. I would say like Madrid scene right now, it changed a lot, and actually changed a lot in the last five, 7 years. Now it's very vibrant, it's very organic. And this is because of the recession, in a way, of the crisis, but also because now it's kind of like a trendy place to be in Spain. Barcelona used to be in the 90s, at the beginning of the 2000s, but now it's the Madrid time. And the city is getting young curators, artists, even galleries opening. I mean, we have last week, we have two new galleries opening. Next week, we have new space opening. So in a way, we think there's a future in the city.
For Monocle in Madrid, I'm Liam Aldous.
So that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be meeting a real character in the LA radio world who knew Elvis, no less, and much more besides. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and Holly Fisher transformed this show from a sea of sound into a beautifully crafted sailing boat. Time for one final song this week from his Midori House session. This is Grammy Award-winning Steve Earle with Burning It Down. Thanks for tuning in.
I was a boy, there were no limitations. Said my goodbyes in the Greyhound station. Here I am, a half a mile from where I grew up, in a parking lot, sitting in a pickup truck, and I'm thinking about burning it down, boys. Thinking about burning it down. Nothing's ever gonna be the same in this town. 10 gallons of gas and a bottle of propane. Electric igniter off my grill and sticking. Say for certain this thing will blow. But if it doesn't, gonna be the first one to know. And I'm thinking about burning it down, boys. Thinking about burning it down. Nothing's ever gonna be the same in this town. I'm thinking about burning the Walmart down. Always used to say, come back someday and settle down. Now I'm getting old, no place else to go. It's all